In this hour of the program, we're also pleased to welcome back Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice physician at Carle Clinic, and every other month he is here. It's on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor. That's the idea. If you have questions about your health or that of your kids, you can give us a call. He deals with both adults and kids in his practice and would be very happy to try to help you out. Now, whenever we have physicians on the program, I also just suggest to people that they understand we cannot do diagnosis over the phone. There's some limit as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But I don't want to discourage people from calling. This is we do this to give you a resource, a place to start. If you have health questions, you can call and talk about it with the doctor. And then, of course, if you have a serious problem, you want to go and consult your own doctor or someone who actually can see you. But, of course, anybody can call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
We have a caller ready to go. We will not delay. We'll get right to them. In Urbana, line one.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for being on the show as often as you are. And I have a general question about stroke and really what is stroke. I'm older, I'm 67. Not that I'm having any problems, just, you know, kind of curious as what is stroke and what are the symptoms. And I know that if one has a heart attack and gets over to the emergency room or to their doctor, that there is a test that can be done to determine that, yes, the person did have a mild or moderate or, I guess, severe heart attack. And I wonder if there is such an easy determining test as there is for heart trouble, as there, is there for stroke?
Well, you raise a very good question. It's going to be a little bit more involved, perhaps, but your use of the term heart attack for what we call a myocardial infarction is a good one. Many people use the term sort of brain attack for a stroke because the idea is similar to that of the heart attack, where you have a fairly sudden disruption in the blood supply.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of a heart attack, obviously, you're blocking the blood supply to the heart muscle itself. In the case of a stroke or cerebrovascular accident, a blockage in one of the blood vessels going to the brain occurs, and this cuts off the oxygen supply to that portion of the brain supplied by that blood vessel. If that is a very transient, short-lived episode, it's referred to as a TIA. You may hear this term used occasionally. That's a transient ischemic attack, but it is a warning sign for the potential of developing a full-blown stroke, which is when an occlusion or blockage occurs in a blood vessel to that portion of the brain that doesn't clear soon enough for the brain to sustain that damage and repair.
How would somebody know that they had this transient attack?
In most instances, the symptoms are going to be very similar to those that we associate with stroke, but they're going to go away within a matter of hours.
Okay, things like dizziness or...
Dizziness is not a particularly useful symptom to separate out stroke from other neurological problems. In most instances, the symptoms are going to depend on which area of the brain has the blockage. So it can be highly variable, but in most instances, this is only going to occur on one side of the brain, mm-hmm. and consequently, the neurological symptoms are usually on only one side of the body. Now, the way we're put together, most of the left half of your brain controls the right half mm-hmm. of your body. So it's seemingly a little backwards there. But in general, if you block off some major blood vessel on the left side of your brain, you're going to have right-sided, in terms of the body, neurological symptoms. And the most common things people will experience is a loss of vision in one eye as opposed to both. They may have some slurring of their speech due to some muscular weakness of the muscles of the face. They may have weakness in an arm or a leg. And generally, you will recognize that something isn't functioning right. This is usually a painless occurrence, not necessarily associated with anything that particularly hurts. If it's transient, it's going to go away in a matter of minutes or hours. Mm-hmm. If it persists, it may indeed turn out to be a permanent deficit. Now, people can indeed recover from strokes, but it depends on how big an area of the brain have you damaged, how long have you obstructed the blood supply and consequently oxygen to that area. And it may take a matter of weeks or months to regain some of the functions that were initially lost. But the risk factors for stroke are very similar to those for developing a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And most cardiovascular risk factors are the traditional ones, which would be, you know, the older you are, the more likely your blood vessels are to become obstructed. Mm-hmm. Males more than females. Certainly anybody with a family history of any kind of vascular disease is at higher risk. Those are factors that you don't necessarily have any control over, but there are a great deal of cardiovascular risk factors that you do have some control over, and those are whether you use tobacco or not, your weight, your blood pressure, your cholesterol levels, your blood sugar. All of these things are amenable to change via diet, exercise, and medications if need be. And these traditional risk factors should be basically minimized if you want to try and reduce your risk of stroke.
Okay. Such things as tingling in the hands is not indicative of stroke.
Not necessarily, no.
What does tingling in the hands, even when sleeping, indicate or suggest an area of examination?
In most instances, the sensation of numbness or tingling or my sort of hand or fingers went to sleep is typically a symptom associated not with circulation problems, but with pressure on the nerve as it runs into the hand.
But not circulation.
Correct. But the only way to sort of sort that out is by physical examination to check the neurological function of the hand and also to check the pulses and circulation into the hand.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Next, we have someone on a cell phone in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A long time ago, I had the cartilage removed from my knee as a kid before, in the pre-arthroscopic days. And then 10 years ago, I had an arthroscopy done on my knee, and the doctor cleaned it up and said, well, you got a beginning of arthritis. We'll see you in a while for a total knee replacement. And I was wondering, in the past sort of 10 years, I've heard about these things like whatever it is, hyaluronic acid, and being able to transplant cartilage and artificial cartilage. Has any of that stuff matured, or am I still looking at a knee replacement sometime real soon?
The only real reason to consider knee replacement is a knee that is so painful that you refuse to live with it anymore. So the judgment as to when a knee gets replaced is entirely based on what you're willing to put up with. So there is no automatic set time when you can look at an x-ray or say at a particular age that somebody needs to have a joint replaced. Really the only indication for replacing the joint is pain that you can't live with anymore, and that varies from person to person. Now, you mentioned a couple of things that you can do to try and make the joint more comfortable, and some of the viscous solutions that are injected into knees can temporarily serve as sort of a cushion for missing cartilage, but those are going to be temporary in terms of the benefit. May last a number of months, but is not going to replace cartilage that's actually missing. So the hyaluronic acid that you mentioned and a couple of other things that can be basically injected into the knee can be symptomatic help, but aren't going to be necessarily a permanent cure for an arthritic knee. Now, it is true that a knee missing a fair amount of cartilage is much more likely to develop arthritic damage, but the rate at which that occurs is going to depend on a variety of things, including your activity level and the types of activities that you're involved in. certainly running is going to put a little bit more wear and tear on your knee than, say, swimming. So in terms of arranging your activities, you may do some things to take some of the physical pressure off of your knee. Anti-inflammatory medications, simple analgesics may provide some pain relief, but again, are not going to fix your knee. The cartilage transplants are still, to the best of my knowledge, sort of experimental, but do potentially offer some hope down the road if they can get to a point where they can actually replace cartilage that's missing with new cartilage that will be viable. I'm not aware that that's necessarily considered the sort of standard of care right now. It's still basically, if you can put up with your current knee, it's the one that's the most functional. If you get to a point where you just simply can't put up with it, then replacing it becomes an option.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. This is the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do every other month with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And if you have questions, call us. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free 800-222-9455. Something I came across and wanted to ask you about, and it actually connects with the question of the first caller. Nowadays, we're starting to hear more and more about erectile dysfunction, and maybe because we actually have medications to treat that. But that's not what I'm going to ask you about. Actually, the study said was that that there might be, if you have a patient who has erectile dysfunction, there might be a good reason to consider that person at risk for heart attack, heart disease, and stroke also, because the mechanisms are similar. And I wonder what you think about that. I mean, it seems to me that actually makes sense.
There are patients with erectile dysfunction who have it on the basis of poor vascular blood supply to the genital area, and there is then at least an association with them having a higher risk of having vascular disease in other parts of the body, including their heart. So there is a reason to look at erectile dysfunction potentially as a cardiovascular risk marker, because generally we're talking about older men who may indeed also have problems with weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, but their erectile dysfunction may indeed be a marker for vascular disease that needs to be looked at. The treatment is still going to be essentially the same, try and modify all of those cardiovascular risk factors, but you may want to be more aggressive about working them up for underlying vascular disease, and certainly being more aggressive about treating their risk factors.
Okay, so but there's that's not necessarily. See, that's interesting. You use the term. We talked about this, I think, with Suzanne Troopin often, the difference between something being a risk factor and a risk marker.
Right.
That there are two different levels of risk in a sense. That one maybe would wave a flag, and yet the other would be more closely a determinant of whether or not the person would have the condition or not.
Right. In terms of erectile dysfunction serving as a marker as opposed to a risk factor, you can treat the erectile dysfunction with all the medications that are now so popularly advertised on TV. That doesn't make their underlying vascular disease go away.
Right.
So all you've done is modify a symptom, but you haven't treated the underlying problem. In the sense, when something is a risk factor like cholesterol being too high, when you bring their cholesterol down, you actually reduce their risk of vascular disease.
Okay. We have some other callers. Let's go next to Chicago and line four. Hello.
Hi, I wanted to know a little bit more about sleep. I've been hearing several different things. One thing I heard was that they now think we need 9 hours rather than 8, or some people do. And also, I had always thought that you could make up sleep, that if you didn't get enough sleep during the week, you could make up the sleep during the weekend. And I heard something that perhaps that's not true, that you cannot make up sleep. And finally, I heard a woman who specializes in geriatrics, an internist, And she suggests that she was talking about the circadian rhythm, and she said that a lot more research is coming out of how that affects your health. And she felt for older people especially, a lot of aches and pains could just be remedied by, she suggested going to bed by 9:30 and getting up by 6 o'clock because she feels that our bodies were adjusted to going to bed when it was dark and getting up when it's light. And if we simply get on that system, we would feel much better. So I guess, speaking for the rest of the sleep-deprived nation, could you tell us something about sleep?
Well, you picked a very sort of hot topic in the sense that I think we're probably just in the infancy of understanding how important sleep is. Most of us certainly recognize how important it is when we don't get enough of it. And on a temporary basis, that's probably not a major problem. But when it becomes a chronic condition of people being either deprived of the number of hours that they need, which is indeed variable from individual to individual, so I can't say that there's any one magic number that fits for everybody. But on a chronic basis, disruptions in either the number of hours or the quality of the hours. You can certainly appreciate the difference in the quality of sleep between a restful 8 hours of deep sleep versus somebody comes in every hour and wakes you up. Mm-hmm. And even though the total number of minutes may be very similar, the quality of your sleep has been disrupted. And there are basically a number of sleep disorders that are known to interfere not only with the length of sleep, but with the quality of sleep. One of the most common ones is obstructive sleep apnea, and these are people who actually stop breathing while they're sleeping, and a very large number of adverse physiological events occur as a result of that. And it's quite true that people who don't sleep well indeed have more aches and pains. They may indeed have a higher tendency toward high blood pressure. And we know that individuals who have apnea are really at significant risk of developing major medical problems as a result of the disruptions in their sleep. So anyone who feels that they're not sleeping well should at least initially look at, am I simply getting enough sleep? And you really can't make up on a weekend an entire week's worth of lack of sleep. You will indeed sleep a little longer than you would have, but it's not going to make up for chronically being short the rest of the week. But people really do need to look at the number of hours that they're getting, and then also the quality of their sleep. And it's very helpful if a bed partner can observe, is this somebody who's sleeping restfully? Is this somebody who sleeps very fitfully? Somebody who snores very loudly and stops breathing? Somebody who's constantly kicking their legs? Restless legs is another type of sleep disturbance that can significantly impact the quality of sleep. If these things are present, it's very reasonable to discuss that with your physician. There are formal sleep clinics available in the community to study very closely what type of sleep abnormality is, and there are a variety of treatments available depending on which condition you're talking about. But there are a number of things that people do themselves that adversely affect their sleep. If you consume caffeine late in the day and then expect to go to sleep, that's going to be a problem. Alcohol, even though it's sedating, interrupts the types of patterns of sleep, generally not very helpful. Some people who find also that extreme exercise late in the evening will prevent them from going to sleep.
I have one more question. If someone is chronically sleep deprived, let's say through most of their adult life, do you think that that could lead to developing panic attacks?
I'm not aware of any direct link between sleep disorders and panic attacks, so I really don't have any special knowledge in that particular area linking those two.
Okay, Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go to the next caller, Biment, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering what you can tell me about Parkinson's disease. Are we any closer to finding a cure?
There is a great deal of basic medical research going on to try and identify the exact mechanisms by which Parkinson's occurs, and hopefully that will lead to some better treatments. Right now, we're aware that certain neurotransmitters, in particular dopamine, are involved with regulating the muscular function that is adversely affected by Parkinson's, and there are medications that alter the way dopamine is utilized in the body to try and improve the neuromuscular function of the body, but it's certainly not a long-term cure simply because we don't know what the primary underlying process is, and that, as I said, is still a focus of basic medical science research right now. So the answer is, are we any closer to a cure? Probably not right this minute, but the work that's going on hopefully will lead us in that direction.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. To Champagne for the next caller. This is line two. Hello.
Yes, I just had a colonoscopy several weeks ago, and I got the report back, and it said it was, they took one polyp out, and it said it was benign and non-cancerous, but it was the type that can become malignant. And they said I should have another one done in 5 years. Doesn't it seem a long time if you got one that could possibly become malignant?
The history here would be helpful. If you have a strong family history of colon cancer or malignant colon polyps, and this was a very large polyp, then it may be reasonable to look a little sooner. The recommendations are 3 to 5 years. If there's no strong family history of cancer and this was a very small polyp, then the 5 years would be considered pretty reasonable. It usually takes a number of years to form a polyp, and it usually takes a number of years for a polyp to then become cancer.
Oh, that's good to know, because there isn't any family history, and I just wondered, it seemed like a long time to wait.
No, actually, that's fairly standard for a relatively small polyp.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, and go again to next caller. This is someone in Gibson City, line three. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question about two medications I'm taking, and both are to be taken 30 minutes each morning before breakfast. Now, for a few years, I've been taking, for a hip problem, Fosamax 10-NG. And then recently, they did a test in my stomach and discovered that I have an irritation. And so I'm taking Prevacid 30 milligrams for my stomach irritation. Now, I'm wondering, if I take them both at the same time, is one going to negate the other, or should I just stop taking the Fosamax while I'm taking the Prevacid? I'm to take it for 2 months.
Actually, there's another alternative here. They make a once-a-week dosage for Fosamax.
Right. I know that my orthopedist explained that to me. I haven't needed to talk to him recently. Is that just as effective as the daily?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that would minimize the overlap between your two medications. And it also may minimize some of the irritation in your stomach. The esophagus, which connects to your stomach, is potentially irritated by taking Fosamax.
I understand that.
It would be reasonable to talk to your physician about whether they think the Fosamax may have any role in the irritation that you have in your stomach, and if so, reducing the taking of the Fosamax to once a week may help that considerably.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't smoke, never have, and don't drink, and don't drink, use caffeine or colas, and so the only thing he thought maybe was just my age. I'm 74. That might have caused the extra acid.
Are you taking any anti-inflammatory agents? aspirin, Advil?
I'm taking a baby aspirin once a day. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he thought that could be part of the problem, too. But 4 years ago, I had a bypass surgery, so I have to take the aspirin.
Right. But I would make sure that you take one of the enteric-coated aspirins.
Yes, we do. Right.
And make sure you take it with food.
Yes, I always do.
Very good.
So, okay, then I'll check on the other. But also, this Prevacid, is there any side effect to taking it for 2 months?
Generally, well-tolerated. Occasionally, people will say they're a little queasy or their bowels are a little loose, but generally, a very well-tolerated medication.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right. We're at our midpoint here. We'd certainly be happy to take as many questions as we have time. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic, and he's here every other month on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is it's wide open, and you know, anything that you might have on your mind, we'll try to cover it. I know he will do his best to answer your question. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Urbana, line one.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have fluid in my left ear where it feels like it doesn't belong, and they gave me a nasal spray to try to clear it, and it hasn't cleared. Is it important to keep complaining about it? Or shall I just hope it'll go away? Or
how long are we talking about?
Well, 3 weeks.
You're probably still in the range where it wouldn't necessarily be considered unusual.
Okay.
So depending on how much it's bothering you, giving it a little bit more time isn't necessarily unreasonable.
Okay.
Most of the time when people have fluid behind their eardrum, they have a little pressure sensation there, they find it difficult to, the phrase is, pop your ears. And it is usually related to the eustachian tube being obstructed.
Mm-hmm.
The eustachian tube is the tube behind the eardrum that drains the middle ear, if you think of it as a floor drain. If something plugs up the drain, then fluid just kind of backs up into the room above. And consequently, that the treatment that you're given in terms of a nasal spray, the idea is that the lining of the nose and your sinuses goes back to the point where the eustachian tube opens. And so if you can reduce any type of swelling in the nose and sinuses, that may reduce swelling in your eustachian tube and help it open up, which will then allow fluid to drain out of the ear. And many times a decongestant nasal spray and an oral decongestant, increasing the amount of water you're drinking, gently trying to pop your ears, because what you're doing is forcing a little air up that tube and hopefully dilating it and opening it up long enough to allow fluid to drain out. We'll occasionally use some cortisone-type medications to reduce swelling. People may need to have their allergies looked at if it's an ongoing problem. Sometimes a physical problem, you know, a really crooked nose or obstructed sinuses can be, you know, surgically fixed. But the vast majority of these occur as a result of usually a bad cold. And it may take several weeks for the swelling to come out of the eustachian tube before that tube opens up and allows that fluid to drain.
Well, good. I'll be more comfortable waiting. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go to Aurora for our next caller. Line four. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. I have a dear relative that has multiple sclerosis, and I just wondered if there's anything new within the last 2 or 3 months that is being done or used, or is there anything you can tell me that is new about the cure of it or the care of it?
No cure. I'm not aware of anything in the last several months. There are a wide variety of newer medications that are being used for multiple sclerosis in the last couple of years, but there are also a variety of different types or subsets of multiple sclerosis. And as the diagnosis and treatment for it becomes sort of more involved, the vast majority of these patients are being cared for by neurologists, usually those with a special interest in this area. So it's really not a subject that I can discuss very cogently in detail, especially not knowing what type or what previous treatments have been used.
You know, I never thought about the different types. I live 1,000 miles away from her, so I can't get that information like you might if you were closer and mm-hmm. visiting. She's quite good about everything. Her attitude is just wonderful. I don't know how she does it. She is taking the injection in her, taking an injection.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought I'd ask because the other question I had was, I need a new drug book, and I wondered if there was anything you knew about that might be a better drug book.
You mean like a reference book?
Yeah, just to check up on a drug and see where it stands as far as any information about it. Or
in terms of how it works compared to other medications?
What?
You'd like to know how a particular medication works, or you'd like it compared to other medications that are similar?
No, I just want to know if you take a medication, what you can expect from it, what the side effects are, that type of thing.
Actually, for any medication that you're prescribed, ideally your pharmacy is providing information in that regard.
Yeah, and I always read the papers I get with it. I think it's wonderful, the printouts they give you on medication mm-hmm. when you get a medication. I just wanted to look, if I wanted to look up a medication that somebody happened to mention. Well, thank you. I guess I'll have to go to the bookstore and ramble through them and see what one seems better to me than another. I thought maybe there was something new out or something you could tell me.
I could suggest there's a fellow that we've had on this program a couple times, and in fact, he was just on last week.
Really?
He's a doctor, not an MD doctor, but a doctor of pharmacy. His name is James Rybacki, and he has now for, a number of years edited the kind of book that you're looking at. Now, of course, I'm here. I've got my computer going. For some reason, it won't give it to me. I think that the book is just called The Complete Guide to Prescription Drugs, and it's published by HarperCollins, and it comes out every year. And so the new one it's called The Complete Guide to Prescription Drugs for 2004. It's a great big book. You could use it to do step aerobics. And it lists the same information that's on the package insert or that's also in this book that doctors all have, the physician's desk reference.
Oh, a PDR?
Yeah, right. And it has those things that tells you.
See, that's too...
Well, it's written, this particular book, it's not written for doctors. It's written for people like us who are not doctors. But it tells you the chemical name of the drug and the brand name of the drug and what it's intended to treat and potential side effects and drug interactions to watch out for and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'll check up on that.
And I think I think it's a very useful thing for
people. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, let's see. We have somebody else here to go to, and that would be in Rantoul, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Doctor, I have had diverticulitis for most of my life, and the last several times when I've been having a difficult time with it, an event has happened that I have never heard of before, and I don't see how one can have anything to do with the other, but that's the only time it happens. I will have a core, like a ball, of intense heat in the center of my head, and then it will radiate out. And I've looked at myself in the mirror. My face has been absolutely red, even my eyeballs. And splashed water, drank some water, and maybe after about a half an hour, it will dissipate and go away. What does one have to do with the other, and what causes this? You know, would have any idea? It's rather frightening, and I have not mentioned this to my doctor.
Is this at a time when you also have a fever?
No.
Then I don't have any way of connecting the two.
But this is the only time it happens.
Right.
Yeah.
The only thing that actually that I can think of physiologically that makes sense is if at the time that you have a flare of diverticulitis, you have an intense inflammatory response going on, generally associated with fever, and that could indeed produce facial flushing and a sense of warmth. But that's
well, this is something that starts deep in my... This is what it, I can only describe what it feels like.
Right.
This is like a ball of heat.
And as I said,
intense heat in the center of my head, and then this gradually dissipates throughout my whole skull, and my face will get red. And
there are a variety of other things that we could think about in terms of causing those symptoms, but they're not necessarily related to diverticulitis.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you have noticed this on several occasions, I do think it would be, you know, quite reasonable to mention it to your physician and have him check it out.
Reasonable is putting it mildly. I know I should, and I am. I guess I'm scared to, like a lot of other people. There's things you know you should do, and you don't want to, and there are answers that you don't want to hear.
Well, I think it's always better to know and deal with, you know, reality as opposed to worrying about things that might not be. So I would really strongly encourage you to mention it to him and let him check it out.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just for the last caller who was interested in this reference guide for prescription and medications, I managed to mangle the title. I do want to give it correctly. However, the book is called The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and the current edition is the one for 2004. And the author is named James Rybacki. That's Rybacki. And he has been editing this thing now for a number of years, and he's been on the program here a number of times, and seems like a good guy. And I think that would suit the need of the listener. So you can take a look at that in the bookstore and see what you think.
I think that would probably be much better because, as you mentioned, the PDR physician's desk reference is not organized or really written in a fashion that. Lends itself to the general public getting much useful information out of it.
Yeah, and this book has a lot of information in there. So I mean, it's quite detailed, but I think you don't have to be a doctor to use it. And again, that's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, 2004, and HarperCollins is the publisher. Let's talk with someone else here. Savoy is our next caller, line two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm just calling in to recommend a drug book that I have that I thought might be what this lady was looking for.
Sure.
It's the Reader's Digest Prescription and Over-the-Counter Drugs. It has usage information, dosage guidelines, precautions, interactions, side effects. It has a pill finder by color and an excellent and extensive index. It talks about drugs in your body, understanding your medications. It's really excellent. I've had it at least 5 years now, and I have found it extremely helpful. So I just thought I would call that in.
Great. Very good. Well, thanks for the tip.
All right, then. Bye-bye.
All right. And you know, there may indeed be a number of other books like this. I guess what people could do is go down to their favorite bookstore and go to the health section and see what sorts of things are there. There must be more than two of these kinds of books,
sure.
I would guess. 333-9455 is the number here for this program. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic. Every other month he's here for the show when we call Talk to the Family Doctor. So whatever's on your mind, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. I don't know if you noticed that there was an article in our newspaper here over the weekend talking about how grocery stores are trying to gear up to respond to all of those people who are on low-carb diets. You maybe saw that. And I guess every time I see something like that, I wonder about it. The Atkins, and I guess maybe there are other diets.
The other popular one that at least starts out as relatively low carb is the South Beach diet. Both of them will indeed result in weight loss in the first couple of weeks. The higher protein, lower carbohydrate diets do indeed initially promote some weight loss. The question that always comes up when somebody talks about a diet is, okay, what are you going to do after the diet? And that's really the problem that I see on an ongoing basis is if somebody will stringently follow almost any diet, they'll probably lose weight, because most of them end up restricting the number of calories that you take in during the course of a day. But it becomes a question of, can I do this for the rest of my life? And for most diets, the answer is no. People either don't like them or get bored with them or just get tired of, you know, restricting themselves. And at some point, you have to say, well, what am I going to do about nutrition for the rest of my life? And if somebody wants to modify their intake in such a way that they're restricting their calories, that's fine. They'll probably lose weight, especially if they'll combine it with increasing their physical activity. It's very, very important to keep your metabolism up, and aerobic exercise, weight training, both can help do that and will facilitate weight loss. But there aren't any long-term studies with things like Atkins or South Beach that say 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years from now that this is a good or healthy thing to do. So I think the verdict is still out. We definitely know that simply consuming too many calories will make you obese. That in and of itself will, in all likelihood, worsen your chances for diabetes, cholesterol-related problems. It's not going to do much for your blood pressure either. And these are all, again, cardiovascular risk factors. And to a large part, the excess of calories, the reduction in physical activity contributes to the fact that cardiovascular disease still remains the number one cause of death in the United States.
Yeah. I think it's very striking that at this time when this particular weight loss strategy, the restricted carb, is so popular, and there are so many people doing it, at the same time, I think a study just came out the other day that showed that overall, Americans, in fact, are consuming more carbs than they used to, and that in part accounts to the fact that we're getting heavier.
Mm-hmm.
So
very true.
Most people are not actually doing that. They're not doing less. They're actually doing more. Let's go to Urbana for another caller here. Line one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. I was told by a doctor that I have a heart murmur. And I really do not understand just what a heart murmur is and what precautions should be taken if it's determined that you have a heart murmur.
Okay. This is a very common situation that comes up quite frequently. The term murmur simply means an additional noise that your physician hears when he or she listens to your heart. In many, many instances, it is a totally normal, physiologic, very common, very benign finding, and it has no medical significance whatsoever. In other instances, it's a sign that a valve within the heart is no longer functioning as normally as it used to. And the only way that you can separate that out is a very experienced physician who's heard many, many different types of murmurs may be able to differentiate them just on clinical grounds, or alternatively, an echocardiogram or sonogram of the heart can specifically take a look at the valves and make sure that they're functioning normally. But heart murmurs are extremely common, especially in children, it's estimated that probably 50% of all kids at some point during childhood probably have a heart murmur, simply related to the flow of the heart briskly going through there. They have very active circulations. But they're actually quite common in adults as well. But it simply depends on the reason for the murmur being present as to whether it's a cause for concern or not. But the vast majority are not.
Well, the doctor said that it was not a cause for concern on my part. I did actually undergo a number of tests with a cardiologist because I was experiencing some unexplained chest pain, even though I'm a healthy and very fit adult.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no problem that was determined from any of that. But one thing that the doctor did say to me is that any time that I have dental work done, I should take a precaution of taking
antibiotic.
Right. And that any person that has a heart murmur should take antibiotics during any type of dental work? I'm unclear
no,
on that.
That is not true.
Okay.
The very common, benign, what we call physiologic or flow murmurs require no special consideration whatsoever. Certain types of valvular changes within the heart are generally thought to be at higher risk of developing an infection on the heart valve when bacteria gets into the bloodstream. And we know that any time that you have any type of dental procedure done, that bacteria from the mouth are getting into the bloodstream. So this is considered a precaution to minimize the chance that bacteria that are getting into the bloodstream would actually end up on the valve in the heart. This actually derives from recommendations from many, many years ago when rheumatic heart disease was much, much more common, and rheumatic heart disease induced damage in the valve, and those valves were much more prone to developing infection, which unfortunately then further damages the valve. So as a corollary to the experience with rheumatic heart disease, it's now currently recommended that anybody who has a significant heart murmur related to their valve just basically take the precaution of having antibiotics on board before dental or other surgical procedures when bacteria may be getting into the bloodstream.
And that includes something as simple as a cleaning?
Yes.
Okay. Does a person just call into the doctor's office and say, I have a dentist appointment coming up and then be on antibiotics for a few days during that time?
Actually, most dentists are familiar with this, and if you simply let your dentist know that your physician has recommended that you be on antibiotic prophylaxis before any dental procedures, your dentist frequently will prescribe antibiotics, most commonly penicillin, if you're allergic to penicillin, usually erythromycin, and it's usually taken just an hour before the actual procedure itself, and that's all you need to do.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, thank you very much for the information.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks. We'll try and get at least one more. We're getting kind of short on time. I'll go next to Champagne in line two. Hello.
Line four?
Yeah. No, this is line two.
I'm sorry.
Well, we'll go ahead. We have you on. Maybe you called in on the toll-free line and it just went to line number two. Yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I've had all the heart tests about 4 or 5 months ago, and I'm supposed to go back in a couple months, but something puzzled me. The stress test was okay and that sort of thing. But the cardiologist said that I have 6,000 additional spikes per 24 hours in the upper channel, and I think it was 8,500 in the lower channel. And he said, well, if you're not concerned, I'm not concerned type of thing. And I take a 1 beta blocker a day, and for LDL, I take a niacin once a day. Do you have any? I just don't understand, and I can't find any reading on that spikes, 6,000 additional spikes.
I'm not familiar with that term, so I'm sorry. I'm not sure I know what you're referring to.
Oh, okay. Well, is this like in the like beats, 6,000 additional beats per 24 hours, more than normal?
You may have what are referred to as premature beats, which are when people are aware of them.
They're all even, and there's no, he said there's no problem with that, but it's rather frightening. Okay.
Again, I'm sorry. I just am not familiar with that particular terminology, so I don't know what you're referring to.
Okay, that's fine.
All right. Well,
thank
I'm
you.
Sorry. We can't. That's about the best we can do, and that's where we'll have to leave it. With promise that next month, Dr. Jeff will be back, and we will do it again.
I'll be happy to.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic. Every other month, he's here for this show we call "Talk to the Family Doctor."